message from Lifeline Productions. 1-800-523-8669. LifelinePro.com.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Another edition of what I call American Exposé. This is Chris Gerner speaking to you on the 12th of April, 2005. Anthony Hargis is back with us tonight, and certainly we'll bring him up momentarily. I see that a college course is being taught at Wesleyan College in North Carolina, and apparently the Bush administration's complicity in the events surrounding 9/11 has now made its way into the curriculum of that college political science department. The course entitled 9/11, The Road to Tyranny, amazing, was brainchild of college professor Jane Christensen, who saw the social need to explore the many questions about the WTC attacks and the war on terrorism. Being taught this spring, the course explores the validity of the government's official 9/11 story, the many alternative theories advanced, and the way the war on terrorism has drastically changed American life. Quote, the events of September 11, 2001 indisputably changed the course of the American politics and history. In particular, the course will focus largely on the specific destruction in Lower Manhattan and the Pentagon, end quote, said Christensen in her course outline. Quote, we are examining the official story and will analyze it critically. We will consider alternative explanations of what occurred on 9/11 and how it became a catalyst for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as the attack on civil liberties in the United States. The goal of this course is to arrive at a social understanding of how 9/11, and we will examine it with a critical eye, end quote. And this is all pretty fascinating. I'll cover this some more tomorrow night. In the meantime, Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, who was the defense secretary in the 1970s during the Ford administration, listeners, and he was implicated in the lawsuit by William Pabst with the concentration camp program in America Today back in 1976. So Rumsfeld has been secretary of defense before. and on a surprise visit to Iraq, warned the country's leaders on Tuesday against political purges and cronyism that could spark, quote, lack of confidence or corruption in government. Keep in mind, the International Monetary Fund is the controlling banker in Iraq today. And that is what I keep covering on a daily basis. But Anthony Hargis is our guest tonight. And certainly in January 2003, the IRS sent a letter to him requesting a meeting. Subject to of the meeting is to determine whether or not he was subject to penalties under a IRC 6700, which is illegal for any person to assist in establishment of plans, arrangements, etc., and represents that expenses of such plans or deductions against taxes, and such person knows such deductions are illegal or grossly overstated. IRC 6701, which is illegal for any person to act as income tax return preparer and enter unlawful deductions on such returns. It's a long, drawn-out situation, and actually it's very reasonable when you get down to it. The government actually claimed that he helped organize illegal tax schemes, listeners, but could find no evidence of it. So we always hear, or quite often hear, of people punished for a crime they didn't commit. Anthony was punished for a crime that never happened. And Anthony, welcome to the broadcast.
Okay, thanks.
Speak as loud as you can tonight. And
okay, can you hear me now?
I can hear you fine, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I received your package yesterday, and Jack was going over your book Thursday. And, boy, you've done quite a bit of research over the years, haven't you?
Well, yeah. Probably the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, you've dedicated your life to waking up the public.
Right.
Because you were concerned about your family more than anything else.
Well, at the time I started, I didn't have a family.
Uh-huh.
But I could, that, well, the thing that really lit my fire was the understanding of the nature of government debt. This occurred for me about 33 or 35 years ago. Now, I came to understand that government debt is a mechanism by which one generation of society imposes taxes on succeeding generations. And it was a process by which, in other words, one generation financially cannibalizes future generations. And I just couldn't see any reason in having children for the purpose of making slaves out of them. And that was one of the pieces of knowledge that really lit my fire. And one thing led to another, and here I am.
I was quite amazed with your book, Fires That Cry. I don't think it was promoted the other day.
No, I don't think that was mentioned. Did you want me to discuss that?
Well, it's just amazing. I opened it up to page 19.
Right.
And I came upon this paragraph, and I'm going to read it to the listeners. Keep in mind, I'm right in the middle of a book entitled, once again, Fires That Cry, A Review of Fairies, the First Industry and Political Correctness, or the Genealogy of the New World Order. I suppose you're talking about Mystery Babylon?
Well, I don't use that term. No, I see, the purpose of the book, the aim of the book was to examine the origins of the New World Order. And I kept going back in years, first 200 years, then 500 years, then 3,000 years, then 10,000, then 20,000 years. I mean, I kept stumbling upon new evidence. And I think I can say that I can trace the origins back at least 10,000, maybe 20,000 years. Now, this goes back to the very earliest dawn of human history, before books were written, for example. Now, the history that I'm talking about here is the history of magic. Most people have no idea where magic came from. Now, the book that opened my eyes on this was, it's called the Golden Bough, B-O-U-G-H, by George Frazer. This originally appeared about 1890 as a set of volumes. I think there were 10 or 12 volumes. Now, this was an investigation of the early human societies and their practice of magic. It's truly fascinating, because by going into the backwoods of human society, we can interview these very primitive tribes, and we can learn their practices, which have not changed in 20,000 years. Now, by practice of magic, I mean as far back as 10,000, maybe 20,000 years ago, every society on the planet, every village on the planet, seemed to have a system of magic by which they thought they could rule the world. If you did a particular dance, they believed you could make it rain, or make the wind stop blowing, or make the sun shine, or make the crops come up, or make the cattle breed, or make easy childbirth for women, or make for success in war, or a successful hunt. It's just incredible. As far back ago as 15,000 years, every village on the planet had very similar practices, very similar beliefs. It was almost as if they established their society from the same handbook. But I don't see how that could have been done. Anyway, the practice here, as with any practice or undertaking, some men will excel more than others in promising these results. These men became known as magicians, sorcerers, witch doctors, and so forth. And their object was to control society. Now, this aim at controlling society, I believe, could be classified as an origin of the New World Order, which aims to control the entire world. First of all, the witch doctor would control a particular village, and as he became successful, he would control two villages, and so on and so on. Now, this magic eventually evolved into religion, and this led me to the Bible. I examined the Old Testament, and there again, there I found, I guess I'm getting into the story of Noah. No, not Noah, Moses. It was Moses that established a contract between the Jewish people, or the Hebrew people, and their God. According to this contract, if the Hebrews would give obedience to their God would give them dominance over the rest of mankind. Here is more, the plan is more particular. They aim at practically nothing less than the domination of the entire world. It was in this contract that the Hebrew people were classified themselves as the chosen race, and everyone else was to be their slave. This is part of this. We can trace the roots of the New World Order through this this covenant between Moses and the Jewish God. Now, I carried this further. I carried this forward into human history, and I found something very, very alarming with regard to the Jewish nation. I came to the conclusion that And I detail this in my book, Fire is a Cry. I came to the conclusion that the Jewish religion was designed to recruit and train tax collectors. Now, the Christian religion was designed to recruit and train taxpayers. The Jewish religion, for example, it manipulates or it guides the reasonably aware Jew into the tax collecting professions of the different countries that they can move into. So basically, Jews are encouraged to never have a country of their own. Their plan is to go into all the different countries of the world, insinuate themselves into the tax collecting professions, loot the country to a Stone Age condition, then exterminate their victims so there will be no witnesses to their crime and no one to warn their next victim. Now, after they loot the country to a Stone Age condition and then exterminate the population or as many of the population as possible, they then exit the country and go on to their next victim. The first supposedly historical example of this exit is the biblical Exodus. If you read the account of the Bible, well, people like to tell you that the Jews were leaving a condition of slavery. Well, the description in the Bible describes no such thing. The Hebrews or the Jews that are leaving Egypt are loaded down with loot, with cattle, with slaves, with household goods, with gold, with silver. I mean, this is not a train of slaves. This is a train of looters. Now, they go to Babylon. They do the same thing. Now, we are told that when the Jews went to Babylon, they were carried in captivity. And then when they left, they were again doing one of their exoduses. In other words, leaving a condition of slavery. But when you read the actual account of it in the Bible, it's no such thing. Again, they are leaving Babylon with tons of gold, tons of silver, 40,000 slaves, and they carry with them a document from the king that allows these Hebrews, when they get to Palestine, to draw money out of the king's treasury in Jerusalem. Again, this is not a train of slaves. Now, like I say, this you just can read this in the Bible. I mean, it's very clear from the description in the Bible, this is not a train of slaves, except the slaves that are carried by the Jews. Now, he carried this forward into the so-called modern times, say, from about, if you consult your written histories, probably the first history would be regarded as written by Herodotus. Herodotus traveled throughout the Middle East about the year 450 BC, and he wrote a history of all that he saw. He described the mountain ranges, the lakes, the rivers, the countries, the kings, and the people that occupied certain lands, and so forth. Nowhere in his history does he mention the word Hebrew or Jew. So apparently, the Jewish nation didn't come into existence until sometime after Herodotus wrote his history, which was about 450 BC. Now, if you read the histories of the Middle Ages, say about 500 AD to 1500 AD, you routinely see references that describe the Jews as the favored tax collectors of the kings and the barons and the lords of Europe, as well as the tax collectors for the Catholic Church. In other words, your uncensored history books will describe the Jewish nation as Europe's bankers and Europe's tax collectors during this time period. Now, they were not the only taxpayers. They were the favored taxpayers of these monarchs and these dictators. So this was the conclusion. Okay, what I'm getting at is now I can actually trace their role as Western tax collectors, or the tax collectors for the Western world, as far back as maybe 2,500 years ago, about the year 500 BC. And at that time, they were not known as Hebrews or Jews. I believe that the Old Testament was written after that time, and it was written to provide a fictitious history for these people who later came on to be Jews. So, I was very generally, and very briefly, that's the outline of my book, Fire Does It Cry. Now, I get the title, Fire Does It Cry. After writing that book and a few other essays and another book, I came to the conclusion there's a maxim of law that says every tax is imposed on the weakest member of society. I mean, everyone tries to avoid the tax, and the more intelligent you are, the more you can avoid it. Who is the weakest member of society? Children and the unborn. In other words, when you impose a tax, it's all the ones that pay the greatest penalty are children. When you take money away from a man, you deprive him the means to support his children. And this practice became so, the taxes became so oppressive in the Roman world, or during the Roman Empire, that I think it was about the year 300 A.D., that Edward Gibbon described the practice of what he called exposure. By this practice, parents would take a newborn child that they knew they could not support and leave this child in the field to expire in the field. And it would take the sun, the wind, the rain, and the cold, maybe 3 or 4 days, to muffle this child's screams. Sometimes the baby would be killed by dogs and wolves. The practice became so scandalous in the Roman Empire that the Roman government enacted measures to reduce the incidence of exposure, but it only served to create more corruption and worsen the problem. Now this is an aspect of human history that hardly any history book will touch. I mean, the effect that taxation has on children. And one of the things that another event, and this is where I get my title, this was done by the priest in Carthage, I believe about the year 320. Conditions in that society at that time were so bad that the priest told the people, your God is angry at you, and he requires a sacrifice of your children. So people brought their children to the temple, and they had this giant statue of a god or a goat or a bull or something that its arms extended into a fire. And parents would place their children or their babies in this god's hands, and the babies would slide into the fire. And the people would dance around and sing and make as much noise as they could in order to silence or to overcome the screams of their children. Here you have children fed to the fire by priests who could not satisfy their lust for taxes or donations to the church. That's where I got my title, Fires That Cry. Fires are our children, and they cry for help. I don't know.
We have children in Iraq right now.
It's happening all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this story, this knowledge of exposure was first brought to my attention by Edward Gibbon. He wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire about 220 years ago. And at the time, like I say, he reported this practice of exposure in Rome 1,500 years earlier, and he said at the time that he wrote his book, in 1770. He reported that at that time, up to 3,000 children a year were exposed in the streets of Peking in China. And other writers wrote at the same time that upwards of 18,000 children were abandoned every year on the streets of Paris. Here are examples where taxes are too high and no one knows the consequences, because the people who pay the most have no voice, they have no understanding, they have no way to file a complaint. And most people just stand idly by and watch them consumed by the fire.
Well, this is where I was enticed in your book on page 19. It says, the practice of child sacrifice continues to this day with procedures spectacularly more efficient than conceived by our savage ancestors a scant 300 years ago.
Right.
While the ancient magicians flayed young girls or roasted infants by the hundreds and right before the knowing eyes of the parents to satisfy the gods and relieve their pious flock of their pains and burdens, the modern magician legislators lead generations of children who are not even born yet into slaughter and slavery. And while our savage ancestors knew their children were being roasted, our savage neighbors haven't a clue as to what is happening.
Right.
This is what required the ancient priests to limit their assessment of a few hundred children at a time, and what allows the modern priests to send millions of children into slaughter without so much as a murmur of protest from parents.
Right.
This is done with government debt, which allows the current generation of magician ministers to enjoy the proceeds of the debt while following generations are required to suffer the payment of the debt. It is called financial cannibalism. Every debt incurred by government necessitates a tax imposed by that government to future generations to pay the debt plus interest. That was the paragraph that made me alerted to this book to see more and to read more.
Okay, I've written quite a lot, and I've forgotten that I had that remark in there. But yes, that's like I say, that's a seems to be a central concern of mine.
What were you thinking of getting into tonight? Did you have anything on your mind that you wanted to cover?
Well, yes, I did. It kind of reinforced, because I just realized that we're on First Amendment radio, and I've written a book about one of the rights that is guaranteed to us by the First Amendment. That's the lost right, or the right of petition. Would that?
That's fine.
Okay, let's see. Now, in reality, this right of petition is actually a right of revolution. That's the ultimate thing that's the ultimate that it can lead to. In the meantime, if the king or the government redresses our grievances, we don't need to abolish or reform government. Now, it's also known as a right to abolish government and so on. Now, what got me interested in this right of petition.
I'll tell you what, keep your thoughts in place. We're about to go to break.
Okay.
We're talking to Anthony Hargis, and you have to have pencils and papers handy to contact him, and I'll give that address when we return, listeners, and I'll give it also at the close of the broadcast tonight. Anthony Hargis, we'll be right back.
All right.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
This program on FirstAmendmentRadio.com is much more than entertainment. It is more like an information-packed audio magazine delivered direct to you. Like any magazine, if you don't want to keep getting it, simply unsubscribe by not listening. But you are listening, so now go to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and follow the instructions there to make a donation or subscribe to your favorite program. Not only should you subscribe for yourself, but you should give extra to help us spread the message at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Don't do Internet? You can also write us. First Amendment Radio, 139 East Tulare Avenue, that's T-U-L-A-R-E Avenue, in Tulare, California, 93274. 139 East Tulare Avenue, that's T-U-L-A-R-E Avenue, in Tulare, California, T-U-L-A-R-E, California, 93274. Thank you.
How would you like to add 20 years to your life? Dr. Earl Mandel, the world's number one leading authority on health and nutrition, has revealed one of the most powerful anti-aging foods ever discovered. It's a 2,000-year-old Himalayan health secret called the goji berry. Dr. Mandel says this is the biggest health breakthrough he has ever seen in 40 years. Backed by scientific research and checked under the microscope, they say the goji berry could very well be the most nutritionally dense food on Earth. So give your body a real treat. Try this most incredibly delicious, all-natural, 100% juice. Your kids will love it, and so won't your pets. It comes with an unconditional 90-day money-back guarantee. To learn more about the secrets of the goji berry, give us a call at 877-888-4777. That's 877-888-4777.
Anthony Hargis is the guest tonight and certainly has several publications that warrant your attention. The American Inquisition is one of them. Plantation America is another one. Maxims of American Law. The Tale of Two Bribes. And earlier we were talking about Fires That Cry and now The Lost Right, which fascinating information. A lot of work involved in what you've done here, Anthony.
Thank you.
Now, the address, listeners, for Anthony Hargis is 2427 North Tustin Avenue, and that's Suite B9. That's Suite B9. That's 2427 North Tustin, T-U-S-T-I-N, Tustin Avenue, Suite B9, Santa Ana, California, 92705. That's, once again, 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B9, Santa Ana, California, 92705. Okay, pick it up where you brought us to when we went to break.
Right. I thought it would be appropriate to talk about my book, Lost Right, because this pertains to a right that is secured to us by the First Amendment. Now, what got me started on this was some research I was doing on the enactments of the American Continental Congress prior to the Revolution, and I found this one document that was unanimously passed by the Continental Congress. The title of this document is An Appeal to the Inhabitants of Quebec. The purpose of this document was to invite the inhabitants of Quebec to join the American Revolution. The date of this document was October 26, 1774, almost 2 years before the official Declaration of Independence. Now, what caught my attention was this passage. The purpose of this document, like I say, was to declare the rights that the Americans wanted to secure with the revolution, and then to invite the Canadians to join the revolution. And what caught my attention was a description of what these members of the Continental Congress described as three great rights of Englishmen. The first great right was the right to participate in government, the right to stand for office, the right to vote for office holders, the right to communicate with government and to make demands on it. The second great right is described in roughly these words: when governments become oppressive, we Americans, or we Englishmen, have the right to withhold our taxes until the government redresses our grievances. The third great right was the trial by jury. Now, I think we can safely say that everyone has heard of the first and third great rights, but no one knew about this second great right. I think I'm the one that discovered it, or is bringing it back to life. Those people familiar with tax law know very well that if you have a grievance, any kind of grievance, you're supposed to pay your taxes first, and then if you have anything left, you can sue to get it back. Well, there's no constitutional, there's absolutely no law in England or America that supports that position. But there is a constitutional authority, namely the one I just mentioned, that supports the practice of redress before taxes. So I found this passage. I had to read it about two or three times to make sure that I understood the meaning. Then I decided, now as it turned out, I had just finished reading a couple of history books on England, and I had noticed some strange things. That is, events where Parliament would frequently require the king to redress a grievance before Parliament would vote taxes for the king. So after reading this passage enacted by the Continental Congress, I decided to go back and research English history, particularly history between 1604 and 1688. This is when Englishmen began to cross the Atlantic to populate the North American continent. This would be an appropriate time to study because this would tell me the law that these Englishmen were bringing with them. Now, this is a fascinating history. If you want to understand the American Revolution or the American experiment, you have to know this English history, as I related in my book, The Lost Right. I think I said it's fascinating. I found scores of examples where Parliament required the king to redress grievances before they would vote taxes for him. There is a very solid history of that supports this policy of redress before taxes. Now, it was not an easy contest. There was always a contest between the king and the Parliament. And at the same time, there were different factions in Parliament. Some were in favor of the king, and some were against the king, or rather, they were trying to establish the rights of the people. Now, every right that appears in the American Bill of Rights was first contended over by these Englishmen. Their first attempt was legislative, or what you might call legislative. They tried to reason with the king. And when he refused to relent or acknowledge these rights, bloodshed would follow. For example, these Englishmen tried to establish the right to speech, the freedom of the press. They tried to make their houses, papers, and effects secure from unreasonable searches. They complained against cruel and unusual punishments. They complained against quartering of troops. They complained against excessive bail and fines. they try to establish the right of the trial by jury and so forth. I mean, every right that we find in our Bill of Rights was first, there was first a contest in England, and the Englishmen spilled a sea of blood trying to establish these rights. They were far less successful than the Americans would be 130 or 40 years later. Now, I said it was a fascinating history. Let me relate one particular example. This was in 1629 in Parliament. Now, these men in Parliament were discussing rights, and they were trying to take privileges away from the king. And the king became alarmed at what these members were talking about. So he sent a messenger to Parliament to say he had dissolved Parliament, which meant he basically abolished the session. It was over. It was ended. But the members of Parliament would not allow it. For the first time in history, these members of Parliament denied the king. They insisted on continuing with their session. Now, there is a man that was a principal character in this drama. His name was John Eliot. He sponsored a proposal that made it a capital crime to impose or collect a tax that did not receive the assent of Parliament. Another portion of this measure made it a capital crime for anyone to pay such a tax. There is a very contentious argument over this measure, and the House of Commons passed it. Now, in the meantime, the messenger went back to the king to report that his message had been rejected, or his intent to dissolve Parliament had been rejected. The king then sent an armed guard. I think it was, I forget the size of this armed guard. It could have been dozens, it could have been hundreds of soldiers that he sent to the Parliament to close the doors and to evict the members of Parliament. But by the time they got there, the Parliament had finished with their debates and had left town. So this effectively shut down Parliament, or closed that session of Parliament. It dissolved it. It was over. It was finished. Now, the king immediately arrested several members of the Parliament that were most vocal in asserting rights, including this John Eliot. He sat in jail for upwards of 3 years. In the meantime, he sent a letter to the king complaining of the unhealthful condition of his jail cell, and he asked for some kind of improvement. And the king responded with three words: not humble enough. So John Eliot remained in jail, and there he died after sitting there for 3 years. And in the meantime, sir, does that mean that we have a break?
We're okay.
Okay. Now, in the meantime, after the Parliament was dissolved, the king and his ministers set out to oppress and destroy these men that were trying to assert the rights of man. For one thing that he did, he would empty his jails of thieves and murderers and put uniforms on them. Then he would quarter these troops in the homes of men who were most vocal in asserting the rights of man. And these troops, I mean, these families had to endure all the obscenities and all the outrages that these soldiers committed against the family. And the families had no recourse. The king wouldn't listen to their complaints. At the same time, the king would draft these men who were vocal in asserting the rights of man, put them in his army, and send them overseas to a disastrous military campaign. And maybe one-third or one-half of them might return home after a few years. It was all planned. This is probably the origin of the complaint of quartering troops in private homes. Now, there were other things that, that happened during this time period. See, this was after 1629. The nation had to suffer these oppressions for 11 years until Charles, see this, we're talking about Charles I. Charles eventually got himself into a situation where he had to call another parliament. He could not steal any more money. I mean, the nation was resisting him full time, and he had to somehow get money, and the only way he could get money was to get it voluntarily at that time. The problem here is that while John Eliot had died, his idea had not. The parliament was convened, and the members raised John Eliot from the dead, and they brought forward his resolution that declared it a capital crime to impose taxes without the assent of Parliament. And Parliament then prosecuted a number of men for violating this rule. They prosecuted a man who had been the governor of Scotland and then the governor of Ireland, and he had been most forward in imposing taxes without the consent of Parliament. They prosecuted an archbishop for promoting the same doctrine. They even prosecuted the king, Charles himself, and they all paid for these crimes with their heads. Now, all these men were prosecuted according to the principles and the procedures that are a part of the right of petition. This is the history, the procedures that Americans do not understand. This knowledge has been erased from our law books and our history books. And this is why I titled my book, The Lost Right. I've recovered this knowledge, and I'm trying to bring it forward to people who have grievances, and there are tens of millions of people out there who have grievances, and they have no idea the power that is available to them with the so-called right of petition.
Now, you spent a period of time in prison or jail. Did you contact or talk to people that were in similar circumstances, such as yourself?
While I was in jail?
Yeah.
Well, no. Everyone that I talked to in jail, now, I did find a lot of people in jail who should not have been there. They were
mm-hmm.
framed, or they were convicted for parole violations. But I wouldn't say that there were any political prisoners in jail. I regard myself as a political prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I was put in jail because I was fairly convinced that the government knew that I had not committed any of the violations that they alleged against me. They were really trying to silence me, and they wanted my records mainly to retaliate against me for the opinions in my books and to retaliate against my customers for supporting me. No, I didn't meet anyone in jail that could be remotely classified with what I've done.
How many customers did you have?
I would guess on the order of 800 to 1,000 reasonably active customers. Now, over the years, I've probably had 1,800 customers, but, you know, some come and some go. So I think a real rough number would be somewhere between 700 and 1,000 customers.
I see. They just took everything you had, didn't they?
Right. See, that was one of the problems the government had. They didn't have the budget to properly investigate me or to prosecute me. So they solved that problem by taking my customers' money, and they use that now to prosecute me while I have no access to it. So you might call that a slight obstruction of justice. I have no means to defend against the case now.
They took your money to prosecute you.
Right, right.
And that's pretty confusing to some listeners out there, I'm sure.
Well, it's a major, I think it's a major violation of rights. You know, that's, like I say, you could classify that as an obstruction of justice.
Mm-hmm.
They knew what they were doing. They knew that if I had the means to defend their case, they would suffer a major loss. Now I've got to go out and find people to support me and to support this case. Now, just to dwell on this for a minute, the hearing that led to my arrest, or the judgment that led to my arrest, occurred in November of 2003. Now, we appealed that judgment. Now, when you do an appeal, you have to request, you have to obtain a transcript of the original hearing. Without this transcript, you cannot have an appeal. Now, we requested that transcript 3 months after the hearing. Well within the, I mean, I don't know if there's a time limit or not, but it was well within the time limit. And my lawyers kept asking, where is the transcript? And the court reporter or the court clerk, I'm not sure which, she eventually told my lawyers, you're not going to get this transcript. The judge has ordered me to quit working on your case. Now, this tells me and my lawyers and anyone else that is interested that the judge himself knows that if this case goes to appeal, there is a fairly certain chance that his judgment will be reversed. Now, if we can do that, this case, this would give us grounds for well, first of all, if we can reverse his judgment, my jail time would become questionable, to put it modestly. It would become illegal, to be a little bit less modest. And the seizure and confiscation of my customer's property would also become questionable. And I'm trying to be very modest here. In other words, a reversal by the Ninth Circuit would give us grounds for a major, major lawsuit against the government. They have committed so many violations. And like I say, the fact that the judge is withholding the transcript indicates that he believes the same thing. And when lawyers hear what have happened to me in this, with just regard to the transcript, they can hardly believe it. It's just almost unheard of that a judge or a trial court will not produce a transcript.
Hmm.
So, now, like I say, this we have the potential here of a major lawsuit against the government that could be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars for each of my customers, maybe millions for each of my customers. I don't know. It could be tens of thousands for each of my customers. It's just a wild guess at this point. But you see, we need money. Or I need money to pursue this, and I'm asking for investors. And if we prevail on this, the investors will receive a return of their money, probably a profit. But I have to stress, there are a number of ifs in this case. What I suggest first, don't invest money with me. Just ask for information. I've got plenty of information that you can examine, or that can introduce you to the case, and that will lead you to more information. And this will give you an opportunity to make a decision. First, maybe you'd want to buy my books and determine whether or not my ideals or the information in my books are worth supporting. I'm a little bit prejudiced. I think they are, of course. But that's what you can... That's a reason that we're giving out my address.
Yeah, absolutely. And the point is that... you've spent a lot of time in research, and you put them on paper, and that is most commendable, because most people don't do anything at all.
Well, yeah, not many people can do that. I have to be one that can, and I soon realized that I was coming across information that could be very valuable and could be very dangerous for the government, and which means very dangerous for me. So I figured that one of the safeguards for my life would be to put my information on paper and begin to sell it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which you've done. Yeah. Fascinating work. And some of it's over my head, I'll certainly, only because of my lack of history.
Well, it's a history that has been hidden from you.
Yes.
You know, it was over my head at first. Some of these things that I read, I could hardly believe. I had to read it 2 and 3 and 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make sure I was reading this stuff. I mean, it's just incredible. You see, what I've done here, what I like to say in my review of The Lost Rite is that your and my stories have already been written 400 years ago. The English, I mean, we have to do precisely what the English did 400 years ago. They dealt with the same grievances that we dealt with. For example, I mentioned the quartering of troops. We have to deal with the same problem here, only they're not called troops. They're called immigrants and welfare recipients. The government is inviting lazy people from all over the world to come into this country and go on welfare. Now, they're not lodged in, precisely in our homes. They are lodged down the streets, and we have to suffer the indignities that they perpetrate, and we have to support them. And if we don't voluntarily support them, the government will send soldiers into our homes to take our property so that they can support these welfare recipients.
We have to stop now and give your address and see what kind of response you receive and bring you on some more. You'll have to email me with a contact number.
Okay.
And that address, listeners, write it down. You're going to want it. You're going to want to correspond with this gentleman. 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B9. That's 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B9, Santa Ana, California, 92705. This is Anthony Hargis, H-A-R-G-I-S.
And you might ask them to send 8 U.S. first-class stamps, and I'll send them all my information.
Okay, that's very, very good. 8 U.S. stamps. To Anthony Hargis, H-A-R-G-I-S, 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B, Santa Ana, California, 92705. This is Anthony Hargis's address. H-A-R-G-I-S is his last name. 2427 North Tustin Avenue, Suite B, Santa Ana, California, 92705. A lot of years of research into these publications that he's put together, and they're very small, but they're well put together, well designed, well done, and thank you for your time, Anthony, tonight.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Let's talk further.
All right.
I look forward to reading your publications. A lot of work here for me,
well,
and thank you for that.
Sure. I appreciate that.
Listeners, we'll be on tomorrow night, and pray for your knowledge to be resurfaced, because we've been diluted and polluted for many, many a month. God bless you all.
Chris, you still here? Chris?
Hear that? That's the sound of nearly 3 million American jobs being flushed down the toilet. What caused it? NAFTA.